Good afternoon, I'm Steve Lappin, and I have been a member, I believe in good standing, for over 20 years. I began coming here in 1996, and I know Everett did the first oral podcast, and one matter in common that Everett and I shared is that we had therapists who for several months tried to encourage us to come to a support group, and neither of us felt that being part of a community of people who were similarly diagnosed would have any effect positively on our mental health. Well, we were both mistaken, and after 6 months and fighting with my therapist, she wore me down and I came, and I am grateful that I have been here for 20 plus years, and in many respects I think it has saved my life. So what I'm hoping to present here is what I would call the middle years. When I had a leadership role, I was president in the year of 2001, and talk about some of the what I consider not momentous, but certain moments in time during that middle era where things really evolved for the better of this organization. Okay? So one of the things I'd like to say is that in the middle years, we experienced an era of group expansion and specialization. The Share Care Committee, which has oversight of all matters related to support groups, invited those who wanted to champion certain theme-specific groups to present their ideas and objectives before the committee. Examples of that were open exchange, LGBTQ, and dual diagnosis. I was the one who developed the Open Exchange, which is a group that invited people who had a diagnosis and family and friends, not necessarily related. And that group actually ran quite well for a period of time, and it's sort of waxed and waned, as many of these specific groups have done so. I should have mentioned that there a number of proposals were brought forward to the Share Care Committee, and not all of them were rubber stamped, but had to have an identified community who would likely attend these groups. So in addition to the above groups that received committee endorsement, there were others that did not. Two groups come immediately to mind. There was an individual who wanted to have a group that focused on those suffering from a trauma history, as well as those who had OCD. And it was quickly determined that such groups should only be run by a professional psychotherapist. And we are decidedly not a therapy-based organization run by professional clinicians. But what we do provide proves to be therapeutic for those who do participate. And I guess what I'd like to say is I think what ultimately determines our sustained success is that we are governed by an egalitarian, not a hierarchical model. Many years ago when I was facilitator coordinator, and back in the day it was called chief facilitator, but that sounded too much of a kind of military moniker, we decided to change the name to facilitator coordinator, and I believe Roberta is our current facilitator coordinator. Chuck, who was president at the time, and I thought it made sense to encourage facilitators to take periodic breaks from facilitating groups and attend as members. After all, what originally brought us here is the commonality of experiencing psychiatric illnesses or conditions and friends and families of those so diagnosed. There was, to my way of thinking, a danger in only inhabiting the role of facilitator, and I remember when I was in that role, I would have periodic trainings. And one of the susceptibilities I pointed out was what's called the star system, what I call the star system, where you had facilitators who were so charismatic that they could not imagine themselves ever stepping down from that role and to become members. And it really struck home with me when one particular person, very charismatic, who ran the wellness group many years ago when it was called wellness and now it's called maintaining stability, that there was one night where he was sick, and I heard a group member said, "Where's the facilitator?" I said, "He's sick." He says, "Well, I can't attend that group." And I said, "This is dangerous." And so Chuck and I thought it made sense to take a break from facilitation, that don't just be a facilitator, because if you do that, you separate yourself from the community of people. And what brought us here? The commonality of suffering from a psychiatric disorder. And so that was something we encouraged, and I think to this day we still have to concern ourselves with the potential danger of one person only becoming a facilitator, because what does that violate? It violates that model of egalitarianism, and it provides an implicit hierarchy. There's the facilitator standing above, and there's the member. During this era, and I think this segues to that particular theme, Chuck Weinstein, our estimable and highly competent training coordinator, developed a training module that would be the envy of many organizations. These trainings were all-day affairs in which exposition and role play help recruit new generations of leaders. But these trainings did not only target prospective facilitators, they also demonstrated how one becomes a positive group member. And one of Chuck's mantras was and remains that an accomplished facilitator will be a guide on the side rather than a sage on the stage. Sometimes I take that into a sort of Jeffersonian context and I say, that facilitator who facilitates best facilitates least. And in some respects, I think there's some element of truth to that. And that's what I think Chuck means by being a guide on the side. What was interesting is way back, Chuck's trainings were so successful that the national organization headquartered in Chicago invited him to present this training module at a number of our national conferences. I have personally attended many of these conferences, I would say 10 or 11 over the years. And it was clear how much respect the thriving Boston chapter garnered among support groups across the country. There were two conferences in which members of MDDA Boston, I'm going to say MDDA because at that time we did not rebrand and go in accordance with DBSA National, and we maintained our own brand of MDDA, which is the Manic Depressive Depressive Association of Boston. So I'm going to switch back and forth to MDDA and DBSA, and when I say DBSA, it's because that's when we accepted the rebranding. But what was really interesting, we conducted in two of these national conferences workshops to other chapters as they wanted to see how we achieved a model of such sustained success. And in fact, in our early years, in the first 10 years, the Boston chapter was honored 6 times by National as one of the best run and most successful groups nationwide. We indeed had cachet, and frankly, it was well deserved. I guess I want to sort of go to the late 90s. A group of leaders from MDDA and the Cole Resource Center decided to develop a speakers bureau as a means of introducing MDDA Boston to the outside community. We had many speaking engagements, and the feedback was uniformly positive. This kind of outreach had an implicit marketing tone as we wanted to continue to grow our numbers of participants attending groups, both evening and daytime, on the grounds of McLean Hospital, and grow we did. I should also mention, and this is a kudos and deep gratitude to McLean Hospital, which has given us this space to use without one penny of rent. They could have had an income stream that most of us would have been salivating over if they wanted to. But we are a recipient of McLean's largesse, and I think it's something we should always remember and remind ourselves of. We get great support from this institution. We were most fortunate, again, to have this kind of unconditional support from two outstanding chief psychiatrists at McLean, Drs. Sherbert Frazier and Bruce Cohen. They not only believed in our works, but they wanted us to have a greater profile among the professional ranks of the McLean clinical staff. Dr. Frazier was so impressed with our model that he had members of Cole and MDDA Boston provide training to incoming residents every month. You could say his wish for us to humanize residents, and that's really what he was hoping to do, so that they didn't simply define their patient populations by their diagnoses. So they wouldn't say, oh, the bipolar guy there who's about 20 pounds overweight wearing that blue shirt. No, he would say Steve so-and-so who's suffering from or has a diagnosis of such and such. Furthermore, I think part of what he really wanted to convey to this incoming professional staff is that we had as much to teach them, if not more, than they had to teach us. And I'll say on a personal note, I was with a psychiatrist for 12 years, and it was a very productive relationship. And I remember him saying to me, I see you as the expert, not me. And I think Dr. Frazier, in fact, behaved in ways that indicated he recognized and respected the expertise that we could provide the professional clinical staff here. It was around this time that we were also asked by the hospital to run inpatient groups in order to expose inpatients to the invaluable resource that peer support provides. And we've been running these groups ever since, and many inpatients as a result have become members and leaders of DBSA Boston. I remember I was doing the group with Everett and then myself on the short-term unit, which primarily treats people who suffer from maybe treatment-resistant depression. And I talked about how I met my wife of 14 years at DBSA Boston when it was MDDA and when I was president. And I will say, in terms of marriage, the third time is the charm. This is a marriage that will last till my last spoken words and her last spoken words. And I'll sometimes say in these groups that I would run in the inpatient group that DBSA or MDDA is not a dating service, but sometimes love happens. And I would then say that's a better bumper sticker than shit happens. it's been a wonderful relationship, and I can't imagine living with anyone but this particular person. And we have been running these groups ever since on many different units, and I guess I would say I had mentioned Dr. Cohen and Dr. Frazier. Dr. Frazier is no longer with us. Dr. Cole now is head of the Frazier Research Institute on the grounds of McLean. And he was offered a position to remain chief of psychiatry of here and at Partners. And it was just too much for him because he wanted to dedicate some part of his day to research. And that job was too burdensome to allow him to do what he loves, which is research. So he left, but I mentioned the Cole Resource Center, and as you might know, that MDDA and McLean Hospital jointly decided to form the Cole Resource Center. And part of the reason for this is because the hospital wanted us to have some kind of center where patients and families could come, could get materials on literature dealing with certain diagnoses, could get referrals for housing, for psychiatric treatment and referrals, for job training, etc. And what MDDA at the time said is that we decided we stick to our knitting. What we do best is peer support and education, as evidenced by our very successful biweekly speakers program. And Dr. Cole, who was a world-renowned psychopharmacologist, also housed at McLean Hospital, who unfortunately is no longer with us, was the one who offered his waiting room for the first modest beginnings, very humble beginnings of MDDA. One of his patients, who was the founder of MDDA, was offered that venue for a peer-led support group. And what I find most remarkable about this is having a person who was so renowned in his field recognize his own limitations and basically saying, I need your help. I can't do this alone. I need you to sort of take the bull by the horns and see what you can do to embark upon your own recovery and discovery of wellness and wholeness. So I thought that was fascinating. I remember years ago when I was running the speakers program here for about 10 years, we brought in a person named Scott Aronson who specialized in treatment-resistant mental illnesses. And he was a chief resident here, and I knew him when I worked. Yes, I worked at McLean many years ago. I come by this diagnosis, honestly. And he was very, I found him to be very compassionate and very bright. And I remember I was struggling for a long period of time with a depression that had no quit in it. And I was beginning to think that I was a malingerer. I was responsible for this. I was to blame. And I approached him. I said, I don't understand. I think it must be me and it must be my fault because I've tried all of these orthodox approaches, including ECT, and nothing seems to break ice with my illness. And he said, Steve, you've got it wrong. You haven't failed psychiatry. Psychiatry has failed you. And that was such a brilliant and, how would I describe, generous statement for a professional of such merit to say. And it allowed me to say, you're right, I shouldn't take this on myself. It's just the luck of the draw and that certain things just haven't worked for me. So I did want to, as I said, I wanted to mention Jonathan Cole because after all, that's the eponym after which the Cole Center is named. And I would also say that during Dr. Cohen's tenure, and like Dr. Frazier, he also conferred a lot of validity and validation on the role we played in teaching others. And he invited members of COLE and MDDA to present at the Grand Rounds on the grounds of McLean Hospital. And upwards of 60 professionals on staff at McLean attended. And this exposure provided ongoing visibility of our peer support model. And I remember I was one of the speakers, and I recalled saying that at this venue that we saw peer support as collaborative and not competitive with clinicians, because we were concerned that clinicians would think we were stealing their patient population. And that was as far from the truth as possible. And I also reassured them that when people came to our support groups who were not in treatment and did not have a clinical treatment team, we would strongly encourage them to find someone to help them deal with symptoms that are so debilitating caused by this illness, and that we knew what our limits were, but we also recognized professionals had that as well. We also, during my tenure in the middle years, expanded the number of daytime drop-in groups as a means of providing structure for those seeking support who may not be able to work. And we have daytime groups which are open to all regardless of diagnosis and are welcoming to family and friends, which meet on Mondays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, as well as Thursday evening's very popular group at MGH. And abundant thanks goes to Dennis Hagler, another principal of DBSA, who spearheaded this group and has remained one of its faithful stewards. I guess I want to say something about share care. I was a many-year past member and many-year chair of the Share Care Committee, and I took pride in how we established our guidelines, which we read at the beginning of every group, as a living, breathing document, and as such has undergone myriad revisions and refinements. It essentially establishes our Bill of Rights and Responsibilities as members of DBSA Boston. I always admired the intellectual vitality of this committee, and I was always impressed by how members were governed by ethical principles of tempering justice with mercy when having to make difficult decisions. And we were called upon to have to make difficult decisions. And we had members in the committee who reminded us that we are a support group and we need to be nurturing, even if we are delivering bad news. But we have to not gift wrap it, but we have to present it in a way that is not punitive, that is not blaming. Without question, my involvement with Share Care remains one of the most enriching experiences I've enjoyed. Also want to give a shout out to Christian, who is now our Vice President and Chair of Share Care, and I think he's doing that. He's serving very well in that role. On the fifth Wednesday, he has actually been the author of this performance series, which is in some sense a refinement and improvement upon what was our annual creativity forum. The original iteration offered more prose and poetry than musical performance. Not surprising when you consider that my creative outlet is the written word and Christian's musicianship, and I was the one who established the creativity forum. But the focus was the same. The intent and focus was the same. It was to say, we do not define ourselves or confine ourselves by our diagnosis, that we are creative, some will say in spite of, others might say because of their experience with psychiatric diagnoses, but it was just a recognition that there's an incredibly rich community of very, very creative, intelligent people, and we need to focus in on that rather than on the ways in which we feel kind of this narrowing and constricting, spiraling down of the effects, the ill effects of mental illness. This was kind of interesting because there was a time when COLE and MDDA had separated and we were working in concert and we complemented what the others did, but there were some concerns coming up, like how do we establish our models in ways that are not redundant, that are not in potential competition or conflict. And our medical advisor, who was advisor to both COLE and to MDDA at the time, Dr. Martin Kafka, who was fantastic, recommended that we have a meeting every month, every year, where leaders of COLE and leaders of MDDA and then DBSA would get together to essentially resolve any potential issues that may come up so that we could work together synergistically. And Dr. Kafka was a master mediator. And I want to say mediating conflict resolution because I don't want to focus that there was a lot of conflict with Colin MDDA, but sometimes we're operating at cross purposes. It was important to have an objective party who could mediate, and he was outstanding in that regard. The other thing I would like to say is that during this middle era, there was a certain shift in focus in the kind of people who came to present. I had a particular love of authors. So I had professionals who had authored books who came in with book signings. I had people doing one-person performance shows during these speaking engagements. But most importantly, I brought in people who have a diagnosis, who told their story of recovery and discovery and resiliency and return to wellness and wholeness. And I thought it was most important to sort of cultivate people from our own community. Significant. But I always found it beneficial to have people who have a diagnosis and family and friends of those who are diagnosed to be able to speak publicly. I was also president during 9/11/01. And this was a particularly painful time, and it served as an opportunity to underscore the value of being part of a nurturing and welcoming community and deriving strength from this connectivity. And you may know that I do write, and I've had many of my pieces published in our quarterly newsletter, The Polos Express. One of the best pieces I have written, and the piece that I'm probably most proud of all the things I've contributed, is my president's address after 9/11. And part of what I wanted to do is I wanted to acknowledge how catastrophic such an event was, and how even though people didn't give expression to how it affected their sense of mental health and emotional equilibrium, you know it had a tremendous effect. And I wanted to give expression to people saying, it's okay to have these kinds of reactions. It's not okay to sort of treat them as traumatic events where you go behind closed doors and get medicated for it. Because to have feelings of anger, rage, and despair, and feelings of vengeance to an event that was so aberrant to begin with is perfectly normal. And so what I was trying to do was encourage people, we are part of this community. This is a community where we care for each other, we welcome each other, we nurture each other. We are not alone. We are not going to condemn you to isolation and marginalization, because that's one of the ill consequences of having a mental illness, to either be marginalized by the other or to marginalize ourselves because of that. And so, as I said, I felt it needed to be expressed, and a lot of people came up to me afterwards and were taken by that particular address. I'm not going to share that with you. It's in the record. The other thing I would say is that when I was president, I was approached by Pharma. At that time, Pharma was flush with cash, and someone came to me and said, "We'd like to give you $15,000 of unrestricted funds. You don't have to even mention us as the donor of this gift." So I certainly wasn't going to agree to that without discussing it with the board. And as a board, we came rather quickly to a decision that we would never sleep with Pharma. We would never accept any money, whether restricted or unrestricted, because we did not want in any way to have our particular mission tainted or tarnished. We did not want to be compromised. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, UMass Medical was one of the first medical schools in the country that made a policy decision that they would not accept any money in their research through Pharma. And that's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. So we made a policy, and to this day, the policy is, and I don't want to say we will not sleep with the enemy, because Pharma is not the enemy for most. It is to me, because I haven't responded well to Pharma. Right. But we decided we can't do that. The other thing that happened is that during my tenure as president, I noticed online that there was this organization called the Float Foundation. And they were, do you know anything about the Float Foundation?
Yeah, I got a grant in there for them.
Oh, what do you mean?
I put in a grant.
You put, because they already have identified us as a charity of choice. I filled out the paperwork.
Right.
DBSA Boston, which I think it was DBSA Boston at the time. Yeah. What these are 30-something very successful professional people who have these three or four events during the course of a year as a fundraiser, and all of the proceeds go to their charities of choice. The first charity, I believe, they designated to support for that 1 year was Massachusetts Breast Foundation. We were the second, and we received $20,000 from them as a result of their fundraising efforts. It was really fantastic. I mean, it was just one of these things that you don't expect. You know, we had a person who gave us during that time, I think it was in the neighborhood of $60,000 to $70,000. A gentleman whose brother had passed, who wanted in his will money to go to. And it was just amazing. And so periodically, these things happen where you least expect it. I mean, I saw this Floor Foundation. I said, this looks interesting. Let's fill out the form. Right. They then called us, and I believe Dennis and I went to Cape Cod where we met with them, and they loved us. We loved them, and we had an event for them when they came, and they gave us a check, one check for $5,000, and that night they gave us a check for $15,000.
Thank you, Steve, for that wonderful presentation.